as a kid, James Weldon Johnson's words, "Lift Every Voice and Sing," it was the seamless part of my childhood. I can't even remember the first time I heard that song.
Lift every voice and sing. It's joy, it's happiness, that in spite of the storm, in spite of everything, you have a song in your heart, you have to sing it.
Hello, everyone. This is Cory Booker, and I want to welcome everybody to the very first podcast of mine, and it's called Lift Every Voice. The goal of this podcast is really to do that, elevate voices that often aren't in the political process, or to raise voices that are strong in issues of, in pointing out issues of injustice and fighting for justice. Some of the greatest voices are those we find in our grassroots or who have never really left grassroots activism. And so on this podcast, our goal is to elevate issues of righteousness, to talk about the larger struggle for the cause of our country, to spotlight people that are doing really important work, and to really, hopefully, let this podcast be inspiring people into activism, inspiring folks themselves to make change, and to help people to realize that every single one of us, no matter who we are powerful. We are powerful. And in a democracy especially, it's the power of the people that is greater than the people in power. And so I believe the stories we'll talk about here are important, if not urgent. I believe the people will highlight, hopefully, will be lights and light workers that can help all of us during challenging and often dark times. Dr. King would have turned 89 years old today. I'm excited to always recognize his birthday and to try to make sure that it's not a time of just recognition, but a time that we are fulfilling his mission and his mandate, which still is real today. We owe him a debt of gratitude, obviously, but the best way to show gratitude is not with words, but with actions. John Lewis is one of the great agents of change in American history, probably one of the more impactful lives that we have. And the great thing about him is he is a consistent man who always has his hands on the plow in the gardening of our democracy. And few people have been recognized as much as John Lewis for their relentless work, for their personal sacrifices. John Lewis worked alongside Martin Luther King. That's why it's so special to have him with me on this first podcast on this time of Martin Luther King's birthday. He was one of the great agents of the civil rights movement, outlasting blows of billy clubs, beating, insults. Multiple times he was jailed. He was considered one of the bravest men in the civil rights movement. Today, Congressman Lewis is representing Georgia's 5th district, and he's done so for the past 30 years. And I've just been inspired to partner with him on legislation, to continue with him and be with him on many important moments of activism. It's a powerful moment of history for me that one of the people whose shoulders I stand upon, now I get to join hands with in a lot of the work as well. It's a powerful moment. And so some of you may know John Lewis. He was one of the big 6 civil rights leaders. And today he's actually the last remaining person alive who spoke at the March on Washington. He was a front row witness to the civil rights movement, participant in the civil rights movement, and somebody that I think is really a special to have with us today. Thank you, Congressman John Lewis, for being the first guest on the inaugural episode of Lift Every Voice.
Well, thank you very much, Senator, for having me. You're a wonderful human being. A wonderful leader. Thank you for all that you do to make the dream of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. come true. I'm honored to be your first guest.
Thank you very much. You and I have talked a lot about your early days, but just a lot. There's a lot of young people out there that I think could get a lot of inspiration from the fact that you were very young. You were a college student. and suddenly were compelled to jump headfirst into the civil rights movement. Can you tell me a little bit about your motivation and that for early those early experiences about you making a very dramatic decision in your life to go full in on a cause for justice?
Well, growing up in rural Alabama during the 40s and the 50s, I tasted the bitter fruits of segregation and racial discrimination, and I didn't like it. I saw the signs that said, white waiting, colored waiting, white men, white women, colored women. And I kept asking my mother, my father, my grandparents, my great-grandparents, why? They would say, that's the way it is. Don't get in the way, don't get in trouble. But one day, 15 years old, in the 10th grade, I heard the voice of Martin Luther King Jr. on the radio. And his words, his voice, inspired me. I heard of Rosa Parks. I grew up 50 miles from Montgomery. And it was like manna from heaven, hearing about Rosa Parks getting arrested, taken to jail, hearing Dr. King delivering a speech at the First Baptist Church in Montgomery. It changed my life.
Wow.
And I kept saying to myself, if the people in Montgomery can do this, we can do something too. So in 1957, I applied to go to a little college called Troy State College. It's now known as Troy University. It didn't admit black students. So I submitted my application, my high school transcript. I never heard a word from the school. So I wrote a letter to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. I didn't tell my mother, didn't tell my father, any of my sisters or brothers, any of my teachers. I told Dr. King in this letter I needed his help. He wrote me back.
Wow.
And sent me a round-trip Greyhound bus ticket and invited me to come to Montgomery.
That alone is spectacular to me, that he wrote you back.
He wrote me back.
And sent you the round-trip ticket?
Well, he knew I was very poor.
Yes.
You know, son of a sharecropper. But my father, in 1944, when I was 4 years old, had saved $300, and a man sold him 110 acres of land. And I think Dr. King had his, what can come out of Troy? Why is this boy doing this? It's dangerous.
Yes.
And I got accepted at a little college in Nashville called American Baptist Theological Seminary. Later became the College of the Bible. I wanted to be a minister.
Right.
You know, growing up as a little kid, on the farm, we raised a lot of chickens.
Yes.
And it was my responsibility to care for the chickens. And we would gather all of our chickens together in the chicken yard. And my brothers and sisters and cousins were lined outside of the chicken yard. But along with the chickens, they helped make up the audience, the congregation.
Yes.
And I would preach to the chickens.
And they would respond to you, right?
Oh, yes. They would make a little noise also. And Dr. King, somehow, in some way, believed that something good can come out of rural Alabama, out of Troy. So I was accepted to a little school in Nashville, Tennessee. And Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. got back in touch. One of his classmates, who was one of my teachers, told him that I was there. And he suggested when I was home for spring break to come and see him. So in March of 1958, by this time I'm 18 years old, I took a Greyhound bus from Troy, 50 miles away, to Montgomery.
Wow.
And a young lawyer, never seen a lawyer, never met a lawyer before, a man by the name of Fred Gray, who was a lawyer for Rosa Parks,
yes,
for Dr. King and the Montgomery Movement, and became our lawyer during the Freedom Ride and during the march from Selma to Montgomery. Drove me to the First Baptist Church, pastor by the Reverend Ralph Abernathy.
Yes.
And I was so scared. I didn't know what to say or what to do. He ushered me into the office of the church. I saw Martin Luther King Jr. and Ralph Abernathy standing behind a desk. And Dr. King spoke up and said, are you the boy from Troy? Are you John Lewis? And I said, Dr. King, I am John Robert Lewis. But he still called me the boy from Troy. And up until he was assassinated.
Really?
He referred to me as the boy from Troy. How's the boy from Troy doing?
That's incredible. And so from that moment, that historic meeting of two great men, you changed your life. You got very involved, obviously, at that point, even more so.
Yeah, well, as a student in Nashville, we started studying the way of peace, the way of love, studying the philosophy and the discipline of nonviolence, studying the teaching of Gandhi. So every Tuesday night for the entire school year, small group of students, about 20 of us, would go to a little Methodist church, and we would study for an hour, maybe an hour and a half. And we became committed to the way of peace, the way of love, to the philosophy of nonviolence. And we were told that if we start sitting in, we may get arrested, we may go to jail, we may be beaten, but you have to make the commitment.
And so what was the first act of nonviolent civil disobedience that you did?
Well, in 1960, we started sitting in. In the fall of 1959, we had what we call tested in. And then on a regular basis, after the students started sitting in Greensboro, North Carolina, on February the 1st, we started sitting in. And you just sit there in an orderly, peaceful, nonviolent fashion, waiting to be served. And sometimes you just look straight ahead. People would come up and spit on you, or put lighted cigarettes out in your hair, or down your backs, pour hot water, hot coffee on you. You still just look straight ahead. And we were told if we continue to sit in, we'd be arrested. We'd be taken to jail. I'd never been arrested before. I didn't have any desire to go to jail. But we were told that may be the price that we would have to pay. And the very first arrest for many of us in that local movement occurred on February the 27th. 1960, when 98 of us were arrested and taken to jail. Then the sit-in spread all across the South like wildfire.
But you and some of your activities faced beatings, vicious beatings. Can you talk to me about that kind of courage and maybe some of those moments where you weren't even sure if you were going to live or die?
But you come to that point where you feel free. You feel that you've been liberated and that you're prepared to give everything you have, that someone had to do it. Someone had to stand in. Someone had to sit in.
Yes.
Someone had to speak up and speak out. I heard Dr. King say from time to time, when you see something that is not right, not fair, not just, you have a moral obligation to do something,
yes,
to say something. And so that's what I've been trying to do since I first met him and heard his voice. It changed my life.
And so that made you, I mean, put yourself in really perilous situations. Can you talk about one of those situations, whether it was a freedom ride or one of the marches where you faced incredible violence and what that does to you?
Well, on the freedom ride took place in 1961. We traveled in an interracial fashion. But even during that period, before we went on the Freedom Ride, we had training. And I remember so well coming to Washington, D.C. the first time in May of 1961, the same year that President Barack Obama was born. It's amazing to me. A group of us came here, 13 of us, and we went to a little restaurant. It was a Chinese restaurant. Now, growing up in rural Alabama, attending school in Nashville, I never had Chinese food before. And it was a wonderful meal the night of May 3rd, 1961. And someone said, you should eat well because this may be like the Last Supper.
Wow.
But wonderful food. And on the morning of May 4th, some boarded a Greyhound bus. Other boarded a trailway bus. And the first violence occurred in a little town called Rock Hill, South Carolina, about 30 miles from Charlotte. My sleepmate was a young white gentleman from Connecticut. The two of us got off the bus, started into a so-called white waiting room. It was marked white waiting, and members of the Klan attacked us, beat us, left us lying in a pool of blood. I thought I was going to die. The local police officials came up, wanted to know whether we wanted to press charges. We said no. We believe in peace. We believe in love. We believe in the philosophy and the discipline of nonviolence. The ride continued, and we arrived in Montgomery. After being stopped in Birmingham, and you go back to Birmingham today, the station looked the same way it did in 1961. But it was one side of the station was marked white waiting, other side marked colored waiting. You couldn't use the same restroom facilities. Couldn't go into the same waiting room. Couldn't sit at the same counter or share the same restaurant. We were stopped by a police commissioner named Bull Connor. Mm. He was known for, he was a member of the Klan.
Yes.
They stopped us right outside of the city. There was a young black man, a schoolmate of mine, and a young white man who was an exchange student at Fisk University from Wisconsin. Bull Connor asked them to move to the back of the bus. They refused to move. So they were arrested and taken to jail. He went down the line in the bus.
Yes.
And our tickets read from Nashville to Birmingham, Birmingham to Montgomery, Montgomery to Jackson, Mississippi, from Jackson, Mississippi to New Orleans. He ordered all of the Freedom Riders to remain on the bus. The two young people who had been arrested, he took them directly to jail. We stayed on the bus for about 3 hours, and then he said, I'm taking you and placing you in jail. We're putting you in protective custody. So we stayed in jail that Wednesday night, Thursday night, and early Friday morning, came up to our cells. We went on a hunger strike. We didn't eat anything.
Wow.
And early that Friday morning, he loaded us in police cars and dropped us off in Klan territory. And some of the young people became very fearful that something would happen to us.
Because you were dropped off in Klan territory.
And, yes. And we made our way to the old house. Some of the Freedom Riders kept saying there must be some... said there must be some colored people here. There must be some black people living someplace here.
Right.
We went to an old house that was leaning, knocked on the door, and an elderly black man came to the door, and we said, we're the Freedom Riders. We're in trouble. We need help. Do you have a telephone? He said, yes. Come in. And we told him we hadn't had anything to eat. And so we gave him some money. And when daylight came, he went to two or three different stores and bought cold cuts, cinnamon rolls, and cheese and crackers for us to, and told us to stay in that back room and let us use his telephone.
But you used a word earlier about how liberating it was to sort of surrender to the cause of nonviolence, to surrender to the ideals of this movement. And this philosophy of love that so penetrates your being, I feel it when I'm in your presence. This calm, unconditional, unyielding love that led you to be beaten on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, beaten on Freedom Rides, beaten at lunch counters. I wonder, can you connect that ideal of love to here we are in present day politics and people all around this country? We don't see often that spirit of love. How does that... Can you tell me about your personal philosophy, this liberating philosophy, and how you see it needed today, maybe?
Well, you know, the philosophy is in keeping with the teaching of Gandhi, in keeping with the scripture. It's better to love than to hate. Dr. King used to say to us over and over again, hate is too heavy a burden to bear. You free yourself, you liberate yourself. And you say, I'm not gonna hate. I'm just gonna love everybody. Dr. King used to joke from time to time and say, just love the hell out of everybody.
Right.
You will feel better. One of the guys that beat us in Rock Hill, South Carolina in May, 1961?
Yes. Those are the buzzes for Congress. They tell us when to go and where to go.
Yes, yes.
But keep going. One of the people that beat you.
Yep.
That
came to my office. Came to my office. Years later, here in Washington, he had been inquiring with local people, members of the press, that he wanted to meet this guy that he had attacked at the Greyhound bus station in Rock Hill. He was in his 70s. He came with his son, who was in his 40s. And a reporter from Rock Hill, South Carolina, came with him. And he came in, and I said, welcome. He said, Mr. Lewis, I've been a member of the Klan. I'm one of the people that beat you and your seatmate. Will you forgive me?
Wow.
I said, I forgive you. He said, will you accept my apology? I said, I accept your apology. His son started crying. Mm. He started crying. They hugged me, I hugged him back, and the three of us cried together. Mm. It is the power of the way of peace, the power of the philosophy and the discipline of nonviolence. But you cannot go around just hating people or putting people down because of their feeling, their being, their past, their color, their nationality. We all are human.
Right. And I often have this conversation with people because I believe in the philosophy of kindness, philosophy of love. But people think that that's weak. You can't win with that, Corey. You have to be mean. And I just watch you as one of my heroes. So evidence that, in fact, the strongest, most enduring way to make change is with love, is with kindness. You don't have to put somebody down in your attempts to lift others up.
It is very consistent with the scripture, the teaching of Gandhi. In Montgomery, Alabama, during the bus boycott, people walked 381 days of shared rides. They didn't fire a gun. They didn't throw a bomb. Other people bombed churches,
right,
and homes.
They didn't demean and degrade their opponents,
no,
their adversaries. And you are a truth teller in the sense that love is hard, love is difficult, love demands that you are an active agent in trying to create justice. In fact, one great leader once said is that justice is what love looks like in public. The dream is under assault with our voting rights. We see civil rights. The dream still needs to advance with still people in our country that don't enjoy the benefits of equal justice under the law. And so here you are, still with your hands on the plow after all of these decades. Can you just give folks, before I start turning to the questions from people on the internet, just your idea of the work we still need to do?
Well, in spite of all of the progress, in spite of all of the changes, there's still deliberate efforts to take us back to another time, another period, to make it harder, more difficult for many of our citizens to participate in the democratic process. You know, being able to vote should be like getting a clean glass of water. People I gave a little blood on that bridge.
You gave a lot of blood, sir.
And almost died. And I don't want to see us go back. I want to open up the political process and let everybody come in. And we're putting people down, especially minorities, elderly people, students. You go to a state like the state of Texas, You cannot use a student ID. But if you have an ID from a receipt from buying a gun, it's okay.
Yes.
But not a student ID.
Yes.
In my native state of Alabama, the way they make it almost impossible for people to get a driving license. So we still have work to do.
I love that this is something you say, but it's also something you live. On every major bills, from criminal justice reform to voting rights to just trying to get people basic access to health care, which as much as the advances we've done under President Obama, we still have a long way to go. There are people that can't afford their prescription drugs. I mean, we still have a lot of work to do.
And health care is a right.
It's a civil right.
It's a civil right.
Yes.
It's a basic right.
In a nation like this.
When I was growing up, we didn't have health insurance. We had barrier insurance. And in so many parts of America today, people are not preparing to live, they're preparing to die.
Right.
And you hear people saying, I need so much money for barrier, but not for living.
Yes.
It doesn't make sense.
It's counter to the ideals of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Yes.
You can't have those things if you don't have health care. Well, let's go to some of these Twitter questions, if you don't mind.
No.
We'll do a little rapid fire for you. And this is something I know you take very seriously, because I see you do it. You wrote this amazing graphic novel, I think, to be accessible to people of all ages about the march and movement. So Olivia Funderburg writes on Twitter, what advice do you have for young people, teens, college students, on how to be an activist to enact change? What's the most important thing we can do?
The most important thing that young people can do, read the literature, study. That's what we did.
Yes.
We studied. We became disciplined. We became disciples of Gandhi, disciples of Martin Luther King Jr., and we were prepared. There were little children in elementary school, middle school, high school, and some people were saying something like, I ain't gonna let nobody turn me around, because they have been touched by the spirit of the movement. Let my teacher register to vote. I'm not old enough to register to vote, but let my teacher, let my mother, my father, my grandfather, you can do something.
I want to keep going with these questions. And these are two powerful ones. Let me go for the first one, because I know you get discouraged. Everyone does. And this is Jennifer Beck, Turtle2Gazelle. That's great, the Twitter handle. Have you ever felt like giving up? And if so, how did you combat that urge and keep up the good fight?
I have never, ever felt like giving up.
You have never?
Never.
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 How about just getting discouraged sometimes?
Well, I see what I call disappointment. I've seen and felt disappointed. And sometimes I feel like we should be much further ahead. And I have this sense of righteous indignation.
Yes.
When there are forces trying to take us back. That we've come so far. We've made so much progress. We still have a distance to go. And we cannot let anybody or any force slow us down or take us back. We have to be consistent and persistent. And we will get there.
Yes.
And we'll be the young people, the children, and their children.
Well, how about this person then? This is Heidi Decker Plays. She asks a similar question. Well, how do we get through the next 3 years without succumbing to fear, despair, and exhaustion? Also, Heidi wants to give you a big hug and a thank you. But how do we get through the next 3 years without succumbing to fear, despair, and exhaustion?
Well, thank you, Heidi. Be unafraid. Don't get lost in a sea of despair. Be hopeful. Be optimistic. Be brave. Be courageous. Be bold. As I said earlier, When you see something that is not right, not fair, not just, find a way to speak up.
Yes.
To speak out.
Yes.
And do something. Organize your friends.
I love that. And in many ways, I love this idea that hope is never letting despair have the last word.
That's right.
And as long as you take a step in kindness and goodness and love, which is actively working for justice, you're going to still advance the cause. So this is a person, they know how to get to my heart by quoting sci-fi, science fiction. This is Anne R. Fanning, and she says, to paraphrase a line in the new Star Wars film, I'm a big fan, we don't win by destroying those we hate. We win by saving those we love. How are we going to save the immigrants from El Salvador, from Haiti, from Nicaragua, that are having their temporary protected status removed from them, being deported back into dangerous situations? How do we save those people without power and water in Puerto Rico? So I guess she's asking, you know, okay, we don't destroy those we hate, we love them, but how do we help those people right now?
We cannot sweep the problem and the concern of our fellow human beings under some rug or in some dark corner. We have to make some noise. We have to put it on the American agenda. We all are human. And what affects one of us affects all of us.
Yes.
And I think sometimes in America we're just too quiet.
Yes.
We're just too quiet. We have to find a way to get in the way. And sometimes, as Dr. King would say, you have to turn things upside down to set it right side up.
I want to just drill down on those for a second, because you said make some noise. And I always say the opposite of justice is not injustice. It's silence.
Yes.
It's apathy. It's letting these things go by without using your voice. And that's something your life is all about. You are maladjusted to injustice. You are definitely one of those people who's maladjusted to any types of injustice. It seems to rankle your soul.
Well, you cannot be at home with it.
Yes.
You cannot accept it. It's not the norm to see people. And we talk about the dreamers. And all of these young people, all our sisters and brothers, members of our families, we all are human. And we should treat each other like we're fellow human beings.
Yes.
And just love everybody.
Yes. But you are about turning things upside down. You have a phrase, I've heard you say it a lot of times, we got to cause some good trouble. What do you mean by good trouble?
I believe in stirring up things.
Stirring things up.
To make it right.
Yes.
To help educate people.
Yes.
To inform people. To sensitize people. That you too can do something.
Right.
You cannot afford to sit on the sideline.
Right.
And be silent.
This is Anna Madsen. She wants to know, where do you find your hope?
I believe in the future. I believe in possibilities. It's, I'm always hopeful and optimistic that somehow, in some way, we're going to make it work out. We have to do it.
Excellent.
It's a calling.
Yes. Let me ask you two more questions really quick. This is Jim. Being a champion of the civil rights, Representative Lewis, do you think that as a nation, under this administration, civil rights is eroding to the pre-civil rights era? And what do we need to do as a response?
I do think under this administration that we're losing some of the gains. And as I said on so many occasions, we cannot let that happen. What happened in Virginia, Charlottesville, made me so sad. I cried. We must insist. We must be bold and fight in a nonviolent fashion at every level. Too many people died to bring us where we are today. We cannot let their deaths be in vain.
Amen. Well, let me ask you this last question, very appropriate for this time where we're recognizing Dr. King. This is from P. Rob, or Paul Rob. What do you think Martin Luther King Jr. would advise us to do today?
Martin Luther King Jr., he could speak to us today, and I think he can. Through our action, our beliefs, he would advise us to never give up, to be hopeful, to be optimistic, to continue to be involved in the political arena, and use our votes, use our voice as a powerful nonviolent instrument or tool to help redeem the soul of America, to help create the beloved community, and that we lay down the burden of race, the burden of hate, and move toward the creation of the beloved community. Move toward redeeming the soul of America.
Yes, and I love that how you talk about the work and the discipline and the study, that we can't just sit back and entertain ourselves, that there has to be a focus and a discipline. And that's something clearly that impressed Martin Luther King about you. And I can only imagine for you going through the civil rights movement, leading into the assassination of someone that you had an intimate relationship with, what that must have shaken, how that must have shaken you. But you turned a tragedy into a triumph because you became a congressperson, you became a national leader, you never yielded when it came to the continued work. And King, at the end of his life, was doing things that were making him unpopular. He was speaking out against war and what was going on in Vietnam. He was challenging the very economic systems that were resulting still in such great poverty with the Poor People's March. And I wonder now, if you think many years from now, when you and I may have passed this earth, when they speak of you, how do you want to be remembered by those who come after us?
Well, people just to say he tried to help out. He did his best. He's just trying to help out. That I was deeply moved and inspired by the teaching of Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. I saw a need. I saw problems that I wanted to try to help solve.
That's really powerful.
That's all we can do.
Let's continue to do our best. Well, you are my hero, and not just because of what you've done, but I just think you're one of those people in my life that is a man of such integrity because I sit with you in the Congressional Black Caucus. You speak little, but when you speak, everybody stops because your words are so consistent with your actions, and you're such a man of deep character, and you make me want to live up to the values that you so live of love, kindness towards even those who hate you, even those who disagree with you, of being willing to make yourself uncomfortable consistently in the face of injustice. So I just want to thank you for being a mentor to me. And you've been from the literally the first day.
Senator, you don't have to say that. I just try to help out.
Yeah.
You remind me, I was coming back to Washington on Sunday night. I was on a flight from Atlanta, and I'm walking down the aisle, and the gentleman said as loud as he could, "Trump." So I just kept walking. I didn't say anything. And sometime I'm walking through the airport in different places, people said, they think I guess they're getting to me, harassing me.
Yes.
But they don't understand. You know, I've been called many, many things, but I'm not gonna let anything get me down.
Yes.
I'll keep walking, keep moving. During the march from Selma to Montgomery in 1965, the guy wrote a little song saying, "Pick him up, lay him down, all the way from Selma town as we march." And that's what we must continue to do.
Pick up our feet, set it
down. Pick up our feet.
Set it down.
That's right.
Keep striding towards freedom.
Right.
King said so eloquently, something I repeat all the time, that he said, "We'll have to repent not for the vitriolic words and violent actions of the bad people, but the silence
that's right.
and the action of the good people." Well, you are good people. But you and the energy you put out is changing lives. And I want to end just with a personal note. The lawyers that helped me move into the town I grew up with, mm-hmm. and I think I first told you the story. When you and I were sitting on the Capitol steps doing a live Facebook feed, and all those people came out really to be with you as you and I were protesting the attempts to roll back healthcare. But when I asked the lawyer who represented my family, was part of the elaborate sting operation that exposed the racial segregation that was going on and racial steering that was going on in northern New Jersey, and I asked that lawyer why he did what he did, and he said to me, and he changed the destiny of my family. And I said, why did you do it? And he said, Corey, I was sitting comfortably at home watching TV, and then suddenly the news broke in to highlight some of these marchers who were going from Selma to Montgomery. And I watched these young people and old people get beaten with billy clubs savagely, viciously. And it so disturbed him that he went to work the next day, and he and his partner ultimately decided, since they couldn't afford to go to Alabama, they would do the best they could to offer help to any civil rights organization in New Jersey they could find. They found the Fair Housing Council, and he would later get a file with my parents' name on it. Your protest on that bridge, even though that day you were not successful, the fact that you stood up with all those other marchers, you instantaneously changed the heart 1,000 miles away in New Jersey, changed the heart of a man who would then go on and change the destiny of generations yet unborn. I would not be sitting here today if it wasn't for that chain reaction of love that was unleashed by one act of protest on a bridge, the Edmund Pettus Bridge. It leapt space and time, the love that you exhibited. And love is work, love is struggle, love is hard. The love that you showed on that bridge today and those other marchers made a way for me, changed my life. And so I owe you a debt I can never repay. And the best I'm going to do is try to pay it forward by trying to live in your example, in King's example, in Christ's example of radical love, love that is risky, love that's dangerous, love that's hard, love that gets mocked, love that gets heckled, love that gets beaten, but to continue in the way that you do every single day. And I witness it and I watch it, that you live with that humility and that love of all. And that strident activism to cause good trouble. Thank you, Congressman John Lewis, for sharing your inspiring story, your thoughts, and your passion with us. I really appreciate your time. And for those listening, I hope you enjoyed the conversation. I'm excited about the stories we'll be sharing on this podcast. So stay tuned for future episodes on everything from environmental inequality to criminal justice to economic opportunity and the future of work. I hope you'll tune in. Thank you very much.
Thank you for being here.
No, thank you.
Thank you for your leadership.
I love you.
And thank you for your friendship. I love you too.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, brother.
Thank you.
Thank you. On that note, you want something stronger to drink, like a Coke?